This episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress. From connectivity to autonomy, AI to machine learning, Ford has one simple goal: to improve mobility for its customers. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com.
Hello and welcome to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of Inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino, and Jason, my co-host, is here as well.
Yo.
Today, joined by the CEO of Arrival, Mike Abelson. Mike is joining us. He's the CEO of Arrival North America, Arrival Automotive. He believes that the future of transportation is fundamentally changing for the better. He has joined Arrival after a long career at GM with the goal of accelerating the adoption of electric commercial vehicles. Without further ado, Mike, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here, guys. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Why don't you start by telling us, Mike, what is the mission here? I know we have Tesla and a lot of electric cars out there. I own four of them. I've been driving electric cars for 10 years. What's your spin on this with Arrival? What are you going to do that's, you know, sort of the opportunity in the market?
So at the core of it, Jason, the mission is to reduce carbon emissions. You know, the world needs to move to answers quicker to address the issues around climate change. And I would tell you, in Arrival, since all we do is electric vehicles, as far as types of vehicles, everyone in the company is dedicated to that mission. Now, you know, what makes our approach different is a whole number of things. Arrival is actually 6 years old and over 1,400 people. And so we're a startup, but we've been around a while. And the great advantage there is it's given us time to develop a whole series of technologies, both for the product, but as well as materials and manufacturing processes and so on, that we think give us a real advantage in the way that we design, engineer, and manufacture our commercial electric vehicles as compared to others.
Who's the target audience for these cars? Or I should say trucks, so right?
They are trucks. In the near term, we've got three products coming. One is a transit bus. One is a what we call a small van, which is a what's known as a Class 2B van in the U.S., and then a large van. So if you think about UPS delivery vans you see on the road, you see quite a variety of sizes. We span that whole product space. And I would say, besides just, you know, working on EVs, we really want to work on how to make life in cities better. These crowded or dense urban areas, we think EVs offer a lot of advantages.
So, Mike, you have 15 years of experience at GM. You were last the vice president of EV charging and infrastructure. Why did you decide to leave GM at this point in your career? Do you not believe in the direction they're taking as far as what they're doing with electrification?
No, in fact, I'm really pleased to see GM and others in the industry now really starting to move towards electric vehicles. All that being said, after being in the industry so long, I really wanted to find somewhere I could have an even larger impact on the electrification of vehicles and the benefits to society. I believe that commercial vehicles were a real opportunity for electric vehicles. And so when the opportunity with Arrival came along, I decided I'd move to Arrival and pursue that option instead of General Motors.
Can I ask you a candid question? Like, you've been in the industry for decades, right? And 10, 20 years ago when Tesla was just getting started, they were kind of dismissed by the overall industry. And here you are, like an executive who was in the industry for decades, now basically choosing to join one. What were the conversations like, you know, 20 years ago when you first heard of like the Teslas of the world making electric cars, and they were kind of dismissed as range anxiety, too expensive, too complex. And now they've become the standard and everybody wants to buy them and everybody's pivoting and going towards them. What were those conversations like in the early days? And then in your mind, candidly, how did they evolve over time to where the entire industry just basically said, you know what, we got to go electric?
Well, Jason, it's a good question. I think in any industry that's been around for decades, like the vehicle manufacturing industry, there are a set of assumptions and accepted truths in the industry. And those are slow to change. And, you know, not just in vehicle manufacturing, but in many other industries, I think you can show that large established companies may not right away understand the change that's going on about them. And it's to Tesla's credit that they were certainly on the leading edge of this and identified the opportunity and really showed what could be done, not just by moving to electric vehicles, but by moving to electric vehicles that challenged some of the assumptions in the industry, even in the way they were engineered.
What were those assumptions that the industry had a blind spot to and was just wrong about when, you know, you were having those discussions? And at what point did you personally have that little sort of, do you remember the moment you were like, wait a second, I think we're wrong. I think electric is the way to go. Because it really is interesting to think about living through a paradigm shift, right? Like we were actually living through a massive paradigm shift in transportation, and now you're in one of the leading companies. So tell me that personal moment where in your own mind, you're like, ah, shoot, he's right. Oh my God, we got to switch this.
So I would say even 10 or 20 years ago, there was broad acceptance that over time, the industry would go electric. I mean, this sort of adoption of different products, it's always an S-curve. And the debate wasn't whether it would eventually become electric. It was all about when. And people always said, yeah, it's probably a couple of decades away. And, you know, there were a lot of people early on with Tesla who said, yeah, they'll build them, but nobody will buy them. Well, you know, once Tesla showed that hundreds of thousands of people would buy them, it gets pretty hard to make that argument. And you just reach a point where you say, it's clear that this is accelerating now. It's not just some sort of linear growth. It's accelerating as far as the adoption of EV vehicles. And that's where you click over and say, you know, if I want to be on the leading edge of this, I need to be with a company like Arrival.
So it seems like it's a pretty crowded space all of a sudden. Obviously you had like, I think am I correct that the Ford Transit is like the workhorse of that sort of industry of trucks, like for deliveries and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I saw Amazon just ordered 100,000 electric delivery trucks. And is Ford going to make theirs, Johan? Do you know if they're making their Transit electric now?
I think they're electrifying the Transit, yeah.
Yeah, they're going to electrify the Transit. So it's going to be a super crowded space. What do you think the dynamics will be? Because the Transit, we were just talking, Johan and I, about the U.S. Postal Service is giving some crazy contract to some company for
Oshkosh,
Oshkosh for some unbelievable amount of money for a disgusting looking, horrible truck that looks terrible.
Mike, did that also piss you off, the design of that vehicle?
I was offended by the design, and then I looked at the spec and I was like, they're saying air conditioning is their big new feature. And I was like, oh my God. But take us through this sort of, if you were going to sell to the post office, what would your pitch to them be?
So let me back up to your first point around the Transit, because Johan made a very important point when he was talking about one of the other vehicles. And if you think back, you saw this in the retail market. Again, Jason, going back to your point about Tesla, at the beginning, you saw a whole variety of automakers that would take current ICE-powered vehicles, take out the powertrain, and put in an electric powertrain and call it an electric vehicle. And Tesla, to their credit, was one of the first ones to say, from the ground up, we're going to design this to be an electric vehicle, and it will only ever be an electric vehicle. I think you're going to see the same thing happen in commercial vehicles. And right now, you have some OEMs that are just taking existing ICE platforms and trying to electrify them. And then you've got other companies like Arrival, who really are designing it from the ground up to be an electric commercial vehicle. And just like we saw in the retail segment, I think over time that will become the accepted approach. Now, to jump forward to your question about the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah.
I haven't found anybody that thinks that's a wonderful design of vehicle.
Wow, that's charitable.
I can only assume that there are a set of requirements from the Postal Service that caused them to look that way, because all of the submissions shared some attributes. But, my point would be, and to the point that we've been talking about, this electric transition is accelerating, and it's really accelerated over the last few years. Well, this process to choose the next generation postal vehicle started a number of years ago. And I would argue that all sorts of things have developed around electric vehicles in the years since that process started. And I really think it behooves us to take a look at, if we had the objective of an electric postal vehicle, because I think anything other than that is behind the times. If you had the objective of an electric postal vehicle, what could it be and what could companies submit? And I think that's the interesting question.
Right. So one thing I wanted to say is that Tesla and GM, two of the companies we've already mentioned, they're taking an approach where they're building these giant facilities in Austin, throughout the United States, right?
Berlin, China.
A ton of electric vehicles, right? Arrival's a little bit different. You guys are focusing on the micro factory, right? One of the few automakers that are really, envisioning this micro factory future. So why don't you tell us what the advantages are as far as building these micro factories and how you guys can achieve price parity with these automakers that are building these giant facilities and churning out thousands of cars a day?
So the advantage, I think, starts from exactly what we've been talking about. We all accept that we're in this time of rapid transition from ICE vehicles to EV vehicles. A traditional EV or a traditional assembly plant takes several years to build. And we see that, it takes planning even before that. So if you're building one of these large assembly plants that creates hundreds of thousands of vehicles, you're doing a forecast several years in the future. You're then investing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars into one of these plants. And you're hoping that the demand materializes when you get there, such right. that the plant is fully utilized. Arrival has developed this microfactory approach. We go into much smaller buildings. We don't need a building built for purpose. We can actually use the building built to be a warehouse. Mm-hmm. And we've significantly lowered the capital investment required to stand up a microfactory as compared to a traditional assembly mm-hmm. plant. And so in this time of great transition, the advantage it gives us is we can deploy these very quickly with smaller increments of capital than a traditional assembly plant. So we can lease a warehouse and have it up and running as a microfactory in 6 to 12 months. This lets us be much more reactive to the demand that we see rather than trying to forecast it several years in the future, which again, in a period of such rapid and significant change, forecasting is really difficult. And this microfactory approach is gives us that business plan advantage. And then as far as how it helps the cost structure, we have developed a set of processes that require far, far less capital to set up one of these factories. And obviously any capital you spend on a plant, you've got to amortize over all the vehicles that are produced there. If you're in a traditional assembly plant, and you've spent hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, then you have to build hundreds of thousands of vehicles
right.
to pay off that investment. When we announced our bus microfactory in Rock Hill, South Carolina, we announced $46 million of investment. Well, since we're only spending $46 million, we can afford the much smaller volume at a microfactory as compared to a traditional assembly plant, and it still works out to be a better business case. So we have a better business case that allows us to react faster to this changing industry. And then the last thing about microfactories, this whole idea around distributed manufacturing, I find really intriguing, because I call the current system sort of winner takes all. One city or one town gets a huge factory.
Right.
Distributed manufacturing, we're going to be in many communities around the U.S. and around the world. And each one of those communities will see the benefits of having manufacturing jobs and a manufacturing business that's paying taxes in that community. So I like to compare it to sort of the farm to table movement, right? People have gotten thoughtful about where their food is grown and what the path is to the table. With these microfactories, we can manufacture vehicles much closer to their eventual market. And as I say, it provides us business plan advantages, as well as, I think, being a better answer for the communities in which we're manufacturing.
Is the business plan opportunity there that because you're going to build 30 of these, 50 of these, let's just say you had 50 of them, one in each state, you get to get subsidies and you get the support of that local community in each one and sort of distribute that wealth and that kind of partnership with local governments?
It is. That's certainly one of the benefits. Another one of the benefits is we don't have to build the same vehicles in every microfactory. And so, you know, if you've got one large centralized factory, there's an upper limit on how much complexity you can handle in that one facility. And so this has led to the approach in today's industry where the automakers tend to want to build one model that they then sell all over the world. We're going in the opposite direction with microfactories and with distributed manufacturing. We can build different vehicles or vehicles optimized for the region that they serve in the different microfactories. So it's a way of also designing and manufacturing vehicles that are really fit for purpose.
Now, Arrival is proposing these two vehicles, the bus and the van. Is there any plans to expand beyond that? Are you going to be offering any vehicles to consumers? And would you say that 5 years from now, you're going to be a direct competitor with Tesla?
So as far as the first part of the question, yes, we have announced that we're working on what we call a small vehicle platform. It's more of a passenger car sized platform, but I don't think of it as a traditional passenger car. Again, at Arrival, we think we have a lot of advantages in the way that we design and engineer and manufacture vehicles. And what we're interested in is how do we apply these in such a way that they support this transition to EV, as well as, you know, you can tell from our focus on bus and van so far, we're very interested in this idea of how do we improve life in dense urban areas. So, you know, we're thinking about how do we leverage this smaller platform to be part of a transportation system in a city as well. And whether that someday leads us to sell to private individuals, I don't know. I think we're going to work on the vehicle and the mission first, and then figure out exactly how and who we sell it to.
I just want to let you know that this episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by our friends at the Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy. Ford has one simple goal, and that's to improve the mobility of its customers. Ford has been using technology to shape the future of transportation for over 100 years and is dedicated to solving the world's most pressing mobility issues. What you might not know is that Ford has a series of divisions that make these visions a reality. Ford X is Ford's venture incubator that unites entrepreneurs, designers, and engineers to shape the future of transportation. Ford's City Innovations team brings innovative ideas to life through community workshops, crowdsourcing initiatives, and citywide mobility challenges. And Spin, a property of Ford, brings e-scooter sharing to cities and college campuses. So here's your call to action. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com.
Have the electric vehicles become massively less complex to build than the IC vehicles? Is that part of the magic here? Is that it's just a much simpler product in terms of the number of components, the amount of complexity?
So it's certainly part of it. Right. The last figure I saw is there are 400 companies in the world that are already either manufacturing electric vehicles or announcing that they will manufacture electric vehicles. Now, you know, that wasn't true back in the ICE days. And I think that, you know, one of the enormous barriers to entry to the industry had always been the amount of capital required to participate. I think one of the things that's really interesting for us is, again, by reducing the amount of capital required to deploy one of these microfactories, it allows us to innovate and experiment with a lot more different types of vehicles than in the traditional industry. But to your question, yes, it is certainly simpler to do an EV vehicle than an ICE vehicle. You just look at the number of parts. And I would argue that Arrival has taken that a step further with the way that we think about this microfactory assembly. We have further simplified it to allow us to deploy microfactories in these small footprints and low capital.
Just now, how would you, go ahead, Jason.
I just wanted to ask about the design. I don't know if you were involved in the current design, but I noticed that when you look at a lot of electric vehicles, they're really designing for aerodynamics. And then looking at your van and looking at your sort of transport, I guess, cargo van versus the bus, they seem to be quite voluminous and designed, I think, to maximize the amount of space inside. So I'm curious what that does to wind and drag, and, you know, are you optimizing, you know, maybe giving up a little bit of mileage in order to get the big, you know, volume inside? And were you involved in the design? Because I would think that everything seems to be sloping. I remember talking to Elon in the early days of Tesla, and he was like, we got to get the mirrors off the side. We got to get the door handles off the side. And then you look at yours and like the bus is like a giant, you know, brick, and it's, it looks like you could have somebody standing on somebody's shoulder inside. I mean, it looks like it's 12 feet high inside, which is kind of cool. You know, it looks like it could almost be a double-decker bus. So talk to me about the design, and then off to you, Johan.
There are several aspects of this. And first, let me make it clear, I was not involved in the actual design. You know, we have very talented folks that work on the surfacing and the design of our vehicles. To your point, commercial vehicles tend to be designed with a purpose in mind, and they're carrying cargo or they're carrying people. So interior volume is important. The other thing is these city environments, speeds tend to be low, which not only makes them a perfect use case for electric vehicles because the speeds are relatively low and there's a lot of stop and go driving, so you get a lot of regen, but it also means that aerodynamics is less important. The importance of aerodynamics goes up considerably as you get to higher and higher speeds. So if you're designing something that's traveling at highway speeds all day, aerodynamics is critical. It's less critical at the lower speeds inside the city. Now, all that being said, I tell you that the drag numbers we're getting on our designs, we do spend a lot of time on drag coefficients, and we get better numbers than people would assume when they're just looking at the product.
Yeah, I had a sense.
Right, right. Question for you on range and price. What can we see these vehicles starting at? What kind of range can you get out of, you know, the van or the bus? Any thoughts there?
So one of the unique, at least as far as I know, technologies that Arrival has developed is the way we go around our battery modules. We designed a single battery module that we use across all of our products. The same battery module is used in the bus and the small van and the large van. Now, the battery modules are assembled into vehicle-specific battery packs, depending on the configuration of the vehicle. The battery modules, though, the way they're designed so that we can add and subtract modules to a battery pack so that we can really design the vehicle to whatever range the fleet operator needs. So we've all heard about range anxiety. You know, range anxiety in the retail space is because people don't really know what range they need. And when they buy a vehicle with a particular range, they're anxious as to whether that's really going to work out for them. That sort of range anxiety does not exist in the commercial space. A fleet operator knows the routes that his vehicles do every day. It's not range anxiety, it's a range requirement. You go to a commercial fleet operator and they say, this is what your vehicle has to do day in, day out over 10 or 15 years in these environmental conditions. And you just have to deliver them, you know, the best price possible on a vehicle that will fulfill that mission. And so it's a long way of saying we offer a whole variety of ranges, but, you know, 100 up to 200 miles typically, of course, it's very dependent on the climate you're operating in and the actual use case. And I would tell you that especially in the electric bus market, the industry's hurt itself a bit by making range claims that then in use can't be supported. So
they overpromise, underdeliver is what you're saying?
Yeah. We would rather work with our customers with exactly the data they have on their routes and design a vehicle that will deliver on that route day in and day out.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. The range anxiety issue, at least, you know, in my experience, hasn't existed since I had the Tesla Roadster, which had like a, you know, 200 mile range, but, you know, it's meant to be driven fast. Kind of real world, we might be 125. But the truth is Americans drive 30, 40 miles a day. And like you're saying, if you're doing a bus route, you know, you've got technology on that bus to know exactly how many miles it does every day at exactly what speed in a database. And you say, listen, this route, the B4 in Brooklyn does, exactly, you know, 222 miles a day. The B16, you know, in Queens, the Q16 in Queens does, you know, 175 miles. So you could actually make the battery packs for each bus perfectly optimized, plus or minus, and that would work with the weight and the whole, and it's perfect.
So I absolutely agree with you, Jason. And what you find if you go talk to people that buy gas engine vehicles, they don't really know how many miles per day they drive typically. They do know how often they have to go to the gas station, but that's the measure. It's not how many miles. So then when you transition into talking about an electric vehicle with a certain range, I think people are concerned about whether that's enough range for them to get around day to day. My experience is like yours. Once you get up into the range that's available now in vehicles, it really isn't much of a problem.
200 or 300. I was just having this conversation with my wife, and I don't know if you saw the new Model S is a 500 mile range.
Right.
And we were sitting there joking and we're like, you know, when we stop on the way to LA with my Model Y, we have to stop once. With the Model X, we have to stop twice. You know, typically 20 to 40 minutes per stop to top it off or whatever. And we're like, whoa, we could drive straight to LA. And it's like, yeah, but we have three daughters and we like to stop and they love to get a, you know, a milkshake and some French fries or, you know, use the bathroom. Like, we have to stop anyway, but we're still thinking of like what a luxury 500 miles is. It's obscene. Like 500 miles in a car is nuts.
Well, and this ability where, you know, most people that are driving EVs are charging it overnight every night. So you start every day with 500 miles. So for the,
and the average American does what, 30, 40 miles a day. I mean, the number of Americans who, you know, do more than that is incredibly, incredibly low. We were talking a little bit about price. Are you going to make your own batteries? Or you have a, I assume you have a partner for that. You're not going to be in the battery business. So what do you think?
Yeah. We're buying the cells from LG. And they've been a great partner. We then assemble those into the battery modules I was describing to you earlier, and then into the battery pack. So the cells we purchase, the rest of it we do in-house.
Yeah, there's a great video online for people who want to watch it if they do a search or go to the website with actually showing like screwing these modules into place. So it's almost like the floorboard could be lifted, I'm assuming, and there would be access to these. So if somebody wanted to upgrade and take the Queens bus and say, you know what, move it over to the Brooklyn bus, we need an extra 50 miles, they could just rivet them in. Is that kind of the concept?
It's not quite that simple, but the concept is, as you described, that you know, if you're using a standard module across several products, it does give you a lot of flexibility as far as interchanging modules.
Now, Mike, where does autonomy come into play? Are you going to develop your own autonomous technology? Or are you going to work with a partner? What's the deal there?
So there are a couple of flavors of autonomous, Johan. I would say the what's called SAE Level 5 autonomous, operating in a dense urban environment on public streets, that is a very, very difficult technical problem that you see companies like Waymo spending a lot of money to solve and a lot of time. Even with all the technology we've developed in-house, we're not trying to develop that sort of level 5 capability. However, mm-hmm. I will say there are some use cases that are specific to commercial vehicles that are of interest to us. So if we are working on what we call depot autonomous. And so if you imagine a fleet of UPS trucks, for instance, that return to a central depot every evening, and once they're at the depot, they're on private property, they're at a facility where speeds are low, where, you know, the vehicles are going from station to station in sort of a set order. You can map it, you can map the depot in great detail. You know, that's an example of a much less technically challenging autonomous problem that is of interest to commercial fleet operators. And we are working on that level of autonomous inside the company. And we'll have some demonstration projects here before the end of the year. Now, going back to the full level five capability, we are designing our vehicles so that they can accept somebody else's autonomous software stack. So we are designing the vehicle with the sensors, with the data architecture, with the redundancies in the chassis, so that if a large fleet operator teams up with one of the software companies to use their autonomous software, they can install that on arrival vehicles.
See, that's my theory, Johan and Mike, is I think there's going to be five people who get there at the same basic time. Let's call it the same 24 months. And if five people get there at the same 24 months, then it's just a race to the bottom of commodity software. You get a license for $50 a month per car to put it in there. And I just figured out the killer feature. Not just the depot one, obviously, that's brilliant. But when a UPS deliverer or FedEx delivery person has to run up into a building, they all get tickets all day long, and they just amortize all these tickets in New York City, and then they negotiate with the city, and they're like, okay, we got $100,000 in tickets this week. How much do we owe you? They're like, give us $20,000. Boom. You know, if you had one of these and you said, you know, do a go around, like, you know, when the pilot has to do a go around, I jump out of the vehicle with your FedEx, you know, or your DoorDash, Johan, with this DoorDash habit you have.
Right, yeah.
I don't know if you know, Mike, but Johan spends like $60 a day on DoorDash. And the DoorDash drive, it's like burritos. He can run out with your burrito. He circles. You finally come down, get your burrito, and then his car just pulls back around. Have you thought about that one, the go-round?
So we're not working on the go-round, but it is, to your point, Jason, you know, it's a real problem for traffic in the city when you have these delivery vans double parked. So there's a lot of interest in solving that sort of issue.
Yeah, and in Boston, my understanding is in certain areas of Boston, the delivery trucks have to be out of the city by like 6 or 7 a.m. And when I lived in Manhattan, I was like, you know what? They should just have a rule. No delivery trucks from, you know, 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. All deliveries, 8:30 p.m. on. And if you want to come into the city like with a delivery truck, they should just ding you with $100 or something, because it is ridiculous in Midtown. These trucks just pull over. Like, you'll have a UPS FedEx truck that's like, yeah, give me a ticket. Doesn't matter. You're not going to tow it. I got to drop off 50 packages here. And then traffic stops. It's ridiculous.
Well, and the great advantage with the EV delivery trucks is you can run them all night. They're not noisy. So
idling.
Yeah.
Force them to run in the evening or overnight.
What do you think there should be more? I'm curious, just on a personal level, do you think the government should be saying, you know what, we just got to penalize people for ICE trucks and for these kind of things and just make it financially brutal for people to not adopt this technology? Are you an interventionist and you think people need to get this? You know, I'm assuming you might have kids or young people, you know, that, or you might care about humanity having joined Arrival. Like, at some point, we got to put our foot down, right?
Yeah, we do.
How would you do it if you were in charge?
What I find really interesting, somewhat to your, consistent with your earlier comments, is you're seeing cities start to sort of take the lead and say, look, we know electric vehicles can bring benefits to the folks that live in the cities. I mean, if you're going to make any vehicle in the city electric, you want to pick those vehicles that are running 8 hours a day, day in, day out, all year. So you want to convert the commercial vehicles and the buses, first of all. And I think that's part of why you see so much demand to electrify those vehicles. You see demand on the city side to electrify them. You see the companies wanting to do it because it makes business sense.
Yeah, I mean, just think about a city being able to say, you know what? Manhattan is now ICE engine free. The air is clean and perfect. And this, can you imagine the noise level in Manhattan?
Oh, man.
it would just go down like 20 decibels immediately. All you would hear is the brakes squeaking, maybe, you know, once in a while, a horn going off. People yelling F you to each other for no reason out the window. You could really hear it more clearly, Johan, when people, when the taxi drivers yell at the truck drivers.
The last time I was in New York City, I was hearing horns honking more than once in a while. But
yeah, it's a cacophony. They have these, it's, the best part of Manhattan is there are these signs like, if you honk your horn, you will get $1,000 fine. And when I lived in Manhattan, like literally there'd be some people who just put their hand on the horn and just leave it there for 3 minutes. And nobody ever got a ticket.
Hard to regulate that.
Pretty hard to regulate that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mike, so how does this partnership with Kia and Hyundai come into play? I know they're two of your major investors. They're also kind of competing with you. I mean, they are building their own electric vehicles. Where do you see that synergy benefiting Arrival?
So Hyundai invested because they are very interested in the work that Arrival is doing in developing technology. To their credit, I think if you watch Hyundai Kia, you've seen that they've been quite aggressive across a whole broad range of innovations in the transportation space. And they're very much, you know, they're a company that's bound and determined that they're going to get through this transition to EV vehicles and be one of the leading vehicle manufacturers on the other side of it. So we continue to work with Hyundai Kia on a variety of fronts. We haven't announced anything publicly, but
I thought you were gonna give us a little spoiler today on the pod.
Sorry, not today. But you know, I will say there are benefits both ways, right? As a traditional automaker, they can help us as a very innovative company looking at commercial EV vehicles. We can help them.
One more business question for you. What was the reasoning behind the decision to, you know, have this company go public via SPAC? I believe you guys are merging with CIIG Merger Corporation, which is a blank check corporation. What was the reasoning there? Why go public now?
So one, I think what you see is the market is highly interested finally in electric vehicles, and there's a recognition of how valuable they can be moving forward. So the market was interested in investing. And then I would say, as we looked inside the company at the pros and cons of either going IPO, call it the traditional way, or by merging with CIIG, the opportunity to do this and to get a significant level of funding in one event and allow those of us like myself to focus on bringing these vehicles to market and running the core business. It just came together as an opportunity that was too good to pass up.
Going public via SPAC, I mean, just is the most efficient way to raise capital today and to optimize valuation. And to, I mean, candidly, I don't know how you feel about it, Mike, but I think public companies will get a disproportionate amount of attention from partners, the press, employees. So it just works on so many levels when you have that currency. Also, if you want to buy other companies, it just really makes the company more attractive for all stakeholders because they get to take their stake in the company and literally trade it, right? So yeah, right. It just becomes a wonderful way. And it's fantastic today that people get to make bets on nascent companies with great potential. I mean, that is the opportunity here. I'm an angel investor for a living. So, you know, if you look at what this SPAC movement that my friend Chamath kind of brought to life has done is it lets the retail investor, the average Robinhood trader, Johan, participate right in what would normally be a private company. Normally the equity being bought and traded here would only be available to venture capitalists and private equity firms and, you know, a Kia or a Hyundai. You'd have to write a $10 million check or $1 million check to come in the door. You certainly couldn't write a $500 check or $1,000 check to participate. And if you think about,
if Tesla had been able to go, Tesla did go public early, but if Tesla had been able to go public in the first 5 years, you could have bought your shares for $1, you know, each, or 25 right, cents right. each. That's what they were valued at. I bought my Uber shares at 2 cents each, you know, just as a as a comparison. Like, you know, they're trading at 50 now. They were literally 2 or 3 cents when they, I think, when they came out, you know. So yeah. It's a great opportunity. Well, Mike, this has been amazing.
We're going to start wrapping up because we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
But as I'm sure, I mean, one big question that our listeners would probably want to know is, when can we expect to see Arrival vehicles on the road? And who are some of the first clients or companies that we'll see roll out these vehicles? Because I'm sure it's very focused on fleet initially, right? Fleet sales.
Initially. So we've announced 2 microfactories so far. The first bus microfactory is in Rock Hill, South Carolina. You'll see buses starting to roll out of that plant at the very end of this year.
Wow.
The first van microfactory is in the UK in Bicester. And you will see the first van starting to roll out from that microfactory in about the middle of next year. Now, you know, we've talked about the microfactory approach, so you can expect to see announcements around additional microfactories here relatively shortly, because we do intend to be producing these vehicles close to where the demand is.
And any word yet on what cities will see these buses first, or what companies will have an Arrival fleet first? I know UPS is one of your customers. Are there going to be rolling those UPS trucks out soon? Anything you can tell us there?
So obviously we have an agreement with UPS. So what I would expect that somewhere in the UPS fleet, once we start producing vans, you'll see Arrival vans pretty quickly. As far as the bus fleets, you know, we announced our North American headquarters is in Charlotte. Our bus plant isn't far away from Charlotte. We have an MOU to work going forward with Charlotte on a variety of public transportation issues, but we haven't announced yet what the first city to actually deploy Arrival buses will be. I will say we did announce a trial or a demonstration in the UK later this year with First Group, one of the largest bus operators in the UK.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts, Jason?
No, I mean, I wish you great success. I think it's awesome that you're really getting focused on this niche, and if you could make me one of these vans as like a tour bus. I've been looking at used tour buses because my friend bought a tour bus, but it cost him literally $500,000 and he has a full-time driver because he doesn't like to fly. So instead of having like a private jet, he just drives around the country. He's like a famous venture capitalist. I won't say their name, but he literally has a tour bus with like 8 beds in it. And it's pretty dope. I mean, I don't know if I want to do these overnight 24-hour drives, but I do think tour buses are on the
Well, I think the ability that Arrival has to do all sorts of different vehicles and different types of vehicles, I would never say never, Jason.
Yeah, exactly. What do you do with the supercharging network? Do you think you can work a deal where like maybe Tesla would let you leverage the supercharger network? Or that's the thing
I think the issue is Tesla uses a specific plug design.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be going with the more common or more widely used
J2.
CCS J2 design.
Yeah. Those are getting faster now. Yeah. Not quite at supercharging levels, but all right, listen, continued success and congratulations on the progress and the SPAC. We wish you great
success. Thanks very much.
Amazing. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, we can't wait to see these things on the road. Have a great one.
Great. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to the Inside Transportation Podcast. We'll see you all next week. Take care. See
ya. Send Johan a burrito on DoorDash.
Send me a burrito.
Send him a burrito.